He finally stopped throwing it back up, which I assumed meant that he was getting better. Andrea helped me lift Gabriel and carry him upstairs. I stripped off his bloody clothes and tucked him into bed. Andrea went downstairs to work over the blood-stained carpet, which she seemed to think she could clean with some club soda. When I suggested kerosene and a match, she was horrified. Stroking his hair back from his gore-covered face, I pressed a kiss to his temple. Jamie came through the bedroom door with a bowl of clean water and a rag. His expression was sheepish.
"Sorry I freaked out down there. I've just never seen anything like that. I mean, I've seen horror movies, but that was..."
"Real life, Jamie. There's no shame in being scared. I was terrified. I'm just better at covering it up." Jamie's brow furrowed as I cleaned Gabriel's face.
"You really love him, huh? Not just the sweet, oh, we met in high school and just couldn't seem to find someone else sort of love, but the epic, desperate, move mountains and cross oceans sort of love."
I chuckled. "I think that would be an apt description. When you realize that someone would do anything for you, even if it means separating themselves from you, risking that you'll never love them again just to make sure you're safe and well, there's no coming back from that. You'll do whatever it takes to be with them. You might want to kick their ass a few times along the way, but when you find that, you don't let it go." Jamie shuddered. "Too mushy?" I asked.
"I'll survive."
Gabriel grumbled in his sleep and shifted against me. I bit into my wrist and let the blood drip into his mouth.
"Hey, you've got to stop doing that. You fed him twice already. Dick said you could drain yourself dry."
"Look who's the voice of reason all of a sudden," I muttered.
"If I was the voice of reason, I would have kept you from giving Dick cash."
I laughed, an honest-to-goodness bark of sincere laughter, and he grinned at me.
"I mean, seriously, I get why you're with Gabriel, as much as it pains me to say it. He has that whole sophisticated older guy thing working for him. But what's with Dick? He's fun for me to hang out with because he's a total dude, but the old Jane, the Jane I knew growing up, wouldn't have looked at that guy twice."
I smiled fondly at him, because I knew he was painfully correct, and nodded to the trunk at the end of the bed. He sat down and folded his long legs under his butt like a child waiting for story time. Did I ever tell you about my first night out as a vampire? He shook his head, and I felt very remiss in my duties as a sire. Mine was a cautionary tale that should be printed and handed out as a how-not-to pamphlet for young vampires as they entered the undead social scene. He said,
"You've mentioned something about freaking out and trying to bite Zeb."
"Well, there was that. But I'm talking about my first night out as a vampire. Out on the town. Back when Andrea was human, she took me out to this vampire sports bar, the Cellar. It was a completely respectable, non-dangerous place. So really, we should have been fine. Andrea had a little too much to drink. I ended up pouring her into my car and running back for my purse, only to find that the bartender was getting roughed up.
By Dick?
By some lowlife who thought that being a vampire was a good excuse to shake money out of food service workers as opposed to getting a job.
So it was Dick,
he said as if I was missing his point. I glared at him. Would you let me tell the story? Said lowlife, whose name was Walter, by the way, turned his less than honorable intentions toward me. We ended up brawling in the parking lot. I held my own until Walter tried to crack my skull like a walnut with his bare hands. I kicked him in the nuts. And Dick stepped in to chastise me for unsportsmanlike conduct. That's how we met.
So the point of the story is, don't go out drinking with Andrea?
No. Well, actually, yes. That's a pretty important life lesson. But the point of the story is, after the fight, I ended up being accused of Walter's murder. After meeting me just once, Dick was willing to speak up for me to the council, to help me clear my name, even though it was clearly in his interest to stay far away from any sort of law enforcement. That's just the kind of guy Dick is. Once you're his friend, there's nothing he won't do for you. And yeah, I do trust him. Because I know exactly how sneaky and underhanded he's capable of being. But he's never lied to me, even when it would have been better for him if he had. That matters.
You're happier now, aren't you?
He asked, sort of squinting at me as if he was seeing me for the first time in a long time.
You weren't ever this settled before. Content, I guess that would be the word. You were always sort of sad and stressed out whenever your mama would drag you to church or family stuff. I always figured it was because, well, you were with your mama.
I snorted. You weren't wrong.
But you were sad, as a human.
I don't know about sad, but I was lonely. There were things in my life I was missing, and I didn't even know it. My life is more now. I have more. And yeah, I had to give up some things, but in the long run, it's not so bad. He took a sip of bottled blood.
I feel like I should be different somehow. I never really liked baseball all that much. I mean, I was good at it, and my dad wanted me on the team, but it wasn't like I woke up in the morning excited because I got to play. And now it's not really an option, and I just don't know what I'm supposed to do with myself. But I'm scared to try anything new in case, you know, I go all crazy and evil.
I was afraid of that, too. But that's not really the way it works, I assured him.
Are you the same sort of person you were when you were human?
That's a good question. I don't think my essential makeup has changed. I still believe in heaven and hell. I still believe that a person should do whatever they can to prevent hurting someone else. Then again, I've killed someone. I've nearly been killed myself. I've got blood or dust on my hands. And that changes you. But you're so young. You were bound to change, whether you were human or vampire. He frowned.
So, it's okay if I don't want to be Mr. All-American Jock anymore?
I put a hand on his shoulder. Okay. But you should be warned. If you start wearing guyliner and go all Prince of the Undead on me, I'm going to pull embarrassing mom stunts. In public. Calling you sweetie in front of your peers, discussing your showering habits and questionable stains in public. I'll put my heart and soul into your humiliation.
Why would you do that?
To amuse myself. Seriously, do you pay attention when I speak? He rolled his eyes and ignored the potential momming of it all.
You think I'll be happy?
I shrugged. What do you want me to say? Be a good boy, say your prayers, eat your vegetables, and everything will turn out fine?
Obviously, the vegetables are a no-go, but I wouldn't mind a little smoke blowing up my shorts.
He deadpanned. I ran a hand over Gabriel's forehead. I sighed. Say your prayers, drink your blood, be nice to your sire, and everything will turn out fine. Was that enough smoke?
Yes. Thank you.
What are sires for? Chapter 8. Take the time to get to know your child. What were his interests before he died? What were his hobbies? Knowing how to reward your child goes a long way in raising him to be a responsible, non-homicidal member of society. Siring for the Stupid, a beginner's guide to raising newborn vampires. I considered it a sign of how much I loved and trusted Dick that nearly 24 hours had passed and I hadn't automatically assumed that he had absconded with my cash. Gabriel was resting comfortably, only waking every few hours to feed, smile weakly at me, and then fade back into sleep. Dick returned the next night. He strolled casually through the door with a cooler full of blood and made it look as if he wasn't scrambling up the stairs to check on his old friend. I was sitting on the window seat, watching Gabriel sleep and reading Jane Eyre while I wound the gray heartstring around my finger. Andrea was running the shop. Jamie was downstairs, considerately playing a quiet game of Madden on our unaccounted-for Wii with Zeb. Jamie was chugging bottled blood as if it was getting ready to expire, but so far he was handling his first prolonged vampire-human interaction like a champ. My ghostly surrogate grandparents were roaming the property, thoroughly upset with themselves for not being able to find any sign of the arrow-slinging hunter in the woods. It was bizarre. There wasn't a footprint or a broken twig to be found.
My buddy at EKU says thanks for the fiver, he said, waving a manila envelope as he came through the bedroom door.
I snorted. Eastern Kentucky University was the site of the only forensic science program in the state. The idea of Dick waiting around in a college lab while a graduate student in an ironic T-shirt did our dirty work made me giggle. Your buddy did this for $5? He smiled indulgently, kissing my head as he handed me the envelope. 5,000. I closed my eyes and reminded myself that Dick had just done me a huge favor, and that I would have to replenish my "the end is nigh, run like hell" cash stash in the library. Was there change? I asked. Dick smirked at me. Never mind. Zeb walked into the room, nursing a sore gamer's thumb.
Oh, good. I was afraid you'd already explained it to her.
I shot Zeb a confused look when he gingerly sat on the foot of our bed.
What? If I miss stuff, it takes me forever to catch up.
I'll spare you a night spent poring over that expensive, not-so-user-friendly report. My buddy Denny said the arrow shaft was soaked in concentrated amounts of liquid caffeine, aspirin, and warfarin, none of which was listed on the arrow's manufacturing label.
Dick and Zeb looked at me expectantly. What? Zeb gave me a hurry-up hand gesture that looked alarmingly mime-like.
This is normally the part where you tell us what that means. It keeps us from having to look stuff up.
We hate looking stuff up, Dick added.
I don't know everything. I'm not omniscient.
Well, she knows what omniscient means, which still puts her ahead of us, Dick snorted.
Fortunately, Denny attached a note to the report. Warfarin is an anticoagulant, once commonly used as rat poison. Large doses can cause damage to capillaries, increasing their permeability, causing diffuse internal bleeding. Combined with aspirin, which would increase the effects of the anticoagulant, plus caffeine to dilate the vessels and speed up the process. Soak a porous wooden arrow in that stuff for a few hours, fire it at an unsuspecting member of the undead community, and you got yourself a recipe for a scary stigmata vampire. Gabe's body couldn't metabolize the blood because it was too thin. His own blood vessels were practically dissolving. It had no place to go but out. Eyes, nose, and mouth were the most convenient exit.
Is there anything we can do for him? I asked. Dick shook his head.
Replacing his blood is a good first step. The next step is fresh frozen plasma, which I happen to have stashed in my car, and massive doses of vitamin K are another. I brought enough for all of us to take so he'll absorb it when he feeds from us. The fact that he's not rejecting the blood anymore is a good sign. Give him a day or two, he should be up and around. Have you called Ophelia?
He asked. Not yet. I wanted to know what exactly we were dealing with before I called, I said. I have no doubt she will come by with her trademark sarcasm and we'll all feel less than placated.
You know she'll ask you who you think did this. Any clue?
I'm not even sure whether the happy archer was aiming for me or Gabriel. He covered me at the last minute, so the arrow could have just as easily hit me. I shook my head. And the DMV lead was a bust. Have you heard anything about a rusted-out black sedan getting any repairs at any of the local shops?
I put an ear out at all the junkyards and body shops that specialize in junkers. None of them saw any car with the kind of damage that would have come from ramming Big Bertha.
I know I said I was going to be proactive about finding who hit Jamie, but I just haven't had time. Clearly, leaving it alone for even a few days was a mistake.
Well, it's not like you haven't had other things going on.
No excuse, I said. I'm not going to let this escalate like I have with all the other thundering loonies I've encountered in the past. This bullshit stops now. I picked up my phone and dialed Ophelia's number. She didn't pick up, sending the call to a pretentious voicemail message about subjecting her consciousness to stuttering incoherent messages that amount to nothing. I rolled my eyes and shut my phone. You know where Ophelia lives, right? He groaned.
Jane?
Dick? I shot back with the same exasperated tone. Dick squeezed my shoulder.
You know, I've noticed that you're okay when someone comes after you, but someone threatens your boyfriend and your dog, you go a little nuts. It's scary as hell.
I am fiercely protective of the people and canines I love, I said. You know that circle includes you.
I know it, Stretch.
I gave him a pointed look, to which he responded with a cross-eyed grimace.
He sighed.
I'll take you there. But if she asks, you're holding me hostage.
When I laughed at him, he exclaimed,
She's scarier than you.
There was no small amount of mockery as Dick drove me to a little two-story ranch house on County Line Road. I had always pictured Ophelia living in some super-mod, black leather and chrome-filled condo. Martha Stewart could have lived in this house. There were flipping geraniums in the window boxes on the front porch. I knew that Ophelia was going to be annoyed by my intrusion, but there was nothing to be gained from waiting. I needed to involve Ophelia now, to ask her for help before anyone else got hurt. I got out of the car and bounded up the neatly swept steps. I had raised my hand to knock on the door when it opened and swung away from my outstretched hand. In front of me was a beautiful little girl. Her cheeks were as white and smooth as ivory. She was wearing a little red cardigan over a pleated plaid silk skirt. She was literally the girl with a golden curl, one adorable little ringlet that hung in the middle of her forehead. Her eyes were ice and fog combined, gray and cold and calculating. I leaned back and checked the house number to make sure I was standing at the right address. I turned to ask Dick if this was his idea of a joke, but he was sitting in the car avoiding eye contact with me. Coward. Is your mommy home? I asked, lifting an eyebrow. Georgie! I heard a voice call from the rear of the house. How many times do I have to tell you not to answer the door without me? That was Ophelia's voice. Ophelia, sounding like an actual teenager for once, instead of the jaded, annoyed council official. I gawked openly at the little girl, and then at Ophelia, who appeared at the door in jeans and a plain white t-shirt. It was the first time I'd seen her in an outfit that didn't feature a theme. She didn't make eye contact with me, focusing instead on the little girl who, I now realized, did not have a pulse or breath. This wasn't a normal kindergartner. This was a tiny vampire.
That's insulting,
the little girl drawled, sounding quite bored.
I would be perfectly safe, no matter who was at the door.
I'm more concerned for the person knocking, Ophelia said, her tone dry. Jane, looking disheveled, what a surprise. Please stay right there without stepping inside my home. Ophelia? What the?
Ophelia, you're being horribly rude. Where are your manners?
Oh, I'm used to it, I assured the little girl. She doesn't like me very much.
She doesn't like anyone very much,
she shot back. Jane, this is my sister, Georgie, Ophelia said, her hand curling protectively around the girl's shoulder. And how old are you, Georgie? I asked, instinctively slipping into the voice I used on the kindergarten students who visited the library.
Old enough to be insulted by that tone of voice,
the little girl deadpanned.
Ophelia said I was her sister. Do the math, woman! Do you have any deductive reasoning skills at all? Honestly, Ophelia, is this what passes for a vampire these days? Why do the newbies always insist on treating me like one of their precious preschoolers? If I'm offered one more juice box, I'm going to be forced into drastic action. It will be Oslo all over again.
Ugh. Georgie, calm down. Ophelia sighed. You barely got away with Oslo the first time. And where would you find a crate of plague rats in this day and age?
Are you challenging my resourcefulness?
Georgie demanded. Does someone need a nap? I asked, patting her head.
Does someone need to be defenestrated?
She retorted, whirling on me. I have to admit that having those little China doll eyes narrowed at me sent a chill down my spine. So I did what any sensible person would do when confronted with a miniature killing machine. I leaned closer and provoked her. I smiled in that saccharine way that drove Jenny nuts. I don't know what sort of low-rent vampires you're used to dealing with, but I know exactly what defenestrated means. And if you think you're strong enough to push me out a window, bring it on, pocket vamp. Georgie's lip curled up as she ground her tiny baby fangs together. The tension in her face suddenly snapped, and she turned to Ophelia.
I like her,
Georgie said, as Ophelia handed her a handheld game unit. She skipped out of the room and settled on top of the kitchen table to play. Ophelia waited for Georgie to clear the hallway and whirled on me.
Perhaps I've made the boundaries of our relationship unclear. We're not friends. We do not pop over to each other's house for a cup of sugar and gossip. If you do not walk right back out that door and forget that you ever saw Georgie, I will make your life so miserable, it will make your sad spinster librarian existence a blissful memory. I frowned, screwing up my lips while I shook my head. Nope. I don't think you will. She blinked incredulously, as if she thought she'd heard me wrong. I smirked at her. Because Georgie likes me, I added. And I get the feeling she hasn't met a lot of new people in the last couple of centuries. Imagine her shock and disappointment if you dismembered the first friend she'd made since moving here. Her face shifted from its unamused stone setting with the slightest ripple of muscles. For a split second, she actually looked defenseless and human. You know, I've heard a lot about you. Ophelia, the badass head of the local council. Ophelia, the brilliant schemer. I've never heard anything about Ophelia, the undead babysitter. Why would I possibly share personal information with you, the vampire equivalent of Jerry Lewis, she who accidentally destroys all she touches? I think you're thinking of Steve Urkel, I said. When she didn't respond, I grumbled. Fine. If you satisfy my curiosity, I will give a full report on the latest buffoonery to befall Gabriel and me. It will help you get ahead of whatever weird-ass catastrophe is heading my way. Consider it a professional courtesy. Ophelia pursed her lips. It's not in Georgie's best interest, or mine, for locals to know about her. It would make both of us too vulnerable. She's well known to the International Council, but Dick's the only civilian in Half Moon Hollow who knows about her, and that's only because of our... For the love of God, just say history, I said, shuddering. Fine. Because of our history, Dick is one of the privileged few to have met Georgie, she said. I don't understand. Aren't there rules against turning children into vampires? She sighed and motioned for me to sit on the sweet little blue corduroy couch in the living room. I could have been sitting in any family room in any home in the Hollow. The walls were painted a soft, warm caramel color. There was a throw rug that blended the tans and blues with a contrasting turquoise. Pictures of Georgie and Ophelia through the ages lined the walls, starting with oil paintings and working toward freshly printed photos. There was a Wii console over the TV and a neatly arranged stack of games. There were several broken controllers tossed into a nearby wastebasket next to a half-dozen still-in-the-package replacement controllers. Apparently, Georgie got frustrated when she lost. Vampire strength and childlike impulse control must have been murder on Ophelia's visa bill. I'm only telling you this because I think it will be of value to you. If you use this information to turn on me...
Yes?
I'm trying to come up with a description of what I'll do to you that won't give Georgie nightmares, she said, frowning. And she saw a good part of the Salem witch trials and the second season of Desperate Housewives. I shuddered as Ophelia cleared her throat. Our parents... brought us over on one of the crossings just after the Mayflower. They were always quick to jump on bandwagons. You can't imagine the conditions on the ship. Hot, cramped, and the smell. It makes me shudder even now. At night, I would go above board just to get a breath of fresh air while everybody else was asleep. And one night, this white face emerged from the shadows, and I was sure I was seeing some sort of ghost. Instead, I met my first vampire. His name was Joseph. He was nearly 500 years old, and he wanted to see the new world. He'd stowed below deck in the hold behind crates and barrels, feeding on rats to avoid being noticed. Now I realize that he must have been lonely and starving, but he didn't try to bite me. He wanted to talk to me. No one had ever really talked to me. People didn't have much use for girls back then, you know? It wasn't just be seen and not heard. It was, you have one purpose on this planet, and while you're not serving that purpose, you don't exist. But Joseph, he was probably the most polite, most genial man I'd ever met. And every night, we talked about the world, about the people on the boat, about my family. I never told my parents about it. I knew they'd either lock me in the brig or decide I was mad, so...
I kept Joseph my secret.
There were problems almost as soon as we reached what would become Massachusetts. The land of promise and plenty was not as advertised. My family fared as well as any of the others, which was not well at all. Everyone was so sick. Food was scarce. We had to work constantly just to scratch out the barest of existences. My vampire friend hovered nearby, watching to see if I was strong enough to survive the fevers and the pox. I wasn't. 2 weeks before my 16th birthday, he turned me before I could die of what was probably the flu.
Ophelia absentmindedly rubbed at the crook of her neck, as if she could still feel the sting of her sire's fangs at her throat.
I rose just in time to find that Georgie had taken ill after I did. I couldn't stand the idea of letting her be buried in an unmarked grave. My friend, my sire, tried to talk me out of turning her. He ordered me not to, as a matter of fact, but she was my sister. I wasn't close to my mother or my father. Parenting, as it was then, didn't exactly foster a warm and loving relationship between parents and children. As far as I was concerned, Georgie was my whole family. My sire was furious with me for what I'd done. He took me before the group of vampires that ruled us at the time, the precursor to what is now the council. They decided that they would let Georgie live, but that I would be responsible for her for the rest of my days. My sire left me in the care of the council for my first 300 years to help foster a better respect for the order of the vampire world. And I wouldn't be able to turn another soul until I was 1,000 years old.
But what's so terrible about a vampire child? I asked. Other than that she's incredibly creepy, and she's obviously hard on gaming equipment.
Ophelia frowned at me, but gave a small smile when Georgie grunted and chucked the game unit against the wall. The fragments skittered across the floor as Georgie crossed her arms over her chest and stuck out her bottom lip. Ophelia sighed.
It wasn't so bad at first. She was always such a sweet, smart girl. She could figure out what was expected of her, where she couldn't cross the lines. But imagine being a teenager in a little girl's body. Or a 40-year-old. You've got all the thoughts and feelings of an adult, but you're trapped in childhood. Georgie will never grow up. She'll never fall in love in a way that doesn't break several laws. Other vampires will never see her as anything but a disturbing liability. I've doomed her to this.
But it's better than being dead, right? I asked as Georgie amused herself by balancing on the very edge of the kitchen counter while standing on her hands. How much worse would it have been to watch her die?
Ophelia smiled fondly. Exactly. There will always be drawbacks, little dramas and problems. But having her with me, being her guide through this life, is worth it. I try not to question my decision because I know I did what was right. I will not feel guilty for it.
I get it, I said, chuckling at the bright, blinking neon hints she was dropping about the similarities between our situations. Incredibly transparent message received. And still, you managed to rise in the council ranks, even though they were pissed at you, she snorted.
I was given a 1,000-year ban on turning another vampire. The council's theory was that I probably wouldn't live that long, so I would be kept from causing any more damage. No matter how high up I am in the vampire hierarchy, I will always have that hanging over my head.
Well, that explains Waco's comment about your first turn as a sire not turning out so well.
Yes, Waco does enjoy his little jokes, she deadpanned. Now, what buffoonery were you referring to earlier?
I see personal share time is over.
Indeed.
I took a deep breath and explained about the arrow, the poison, and Gabriel's current state of coma. I was rather proud that I managed not to tear up or get all quivery-voiced as I spoke, even when I described the torrents of blood Gabriel had thrown up while we tried to force-feed him.
And you suspect foul play? You don't think it's possible that a hunter stumbled onto your property and accidentally shot Gabriel? She asked.
As in,
Oops, I accidentally let a dangerous wooden arrow fall into a solution that could poison a vampire, and then wandered onto the property of one of the few out vampires in town, only to lose control of said arrow and fire it 3 inches to the left of the heart of that vampire's fiancé? Yes, it is an unlikely sequence of coincidences, she admitted. Behind her, Georgie had moved on to standing on the very tips of her toes while balancing on the back of a kitchen chair. I was torn between telling Ophelia and marveling at Georgie's equilibrium. Besides, Jamie says it isn't bow season. Ophelia smirked at me fondly.
I take it that you're acclimating well to life as a sire?
I wouldn't say well, but I am acclimating.
And the dynamic between Gabriel and your young charge? What was Jamie doing while Gabriel was bleeding and vomiting? She asked.
Being a teenager, I responded, controlling the urge to roll my eyes. He was pretty grossed out and upset about the stains on his jeans.
Too grossed out to have been involved in the poisoning?
She asked, her brows knit in an expression of irritated confusion. Gabriel asked the same thing, but I don't think Jamie has this in him. Besides, he was playing video games in the house while we were outside.
Do you have any other suspects?
She asked. I honestly don't know. Jamie's parents were so angry with me over Jamie's becoming a vampire. His dad's a hunter. Do you think it's possible he was angry enough to take a shot at us? She nodded.
We'll look into it. And we'll have trusted vampires do the occasional security sweep by River Oaks.
How occasional? I asked.
Are you questioning the generosity of your council?
She asked, one eyebrow raised. I shook my head, all innocent eyes and guile.
It was good that you brought this to our attention, Jane, rather than waiting until the situation escalated out of your control. It showed an unusual amount of common sense on your part.
Thanks, I think.
It wasn't necessarily a compliment. I'm aware of that.
Chapter 9. Although vampires are seen as lonely, brooding creatures, all of us, whether young or old, need socialization. Vampires who spend too much time alone lose their humanity, and with that, their ability to safely attract and feed from their human prey. Siring for the Stupid, A Beginner's Guide to Raising Newborn Vampires. My first day back at the shop didn't go as I'd hoped. I pulled into the space in front of the shop to find Andrea scrubbing furiously at the window.
Sweetie, I think we've talked about the fact that our customers don't really care about the cleanliness of the front window. They sort of like the idea that no one can see them from the outside, I called as I climbed out of Big Bertha.
Andrea ignored me, continuing to swipe at the soapy glass. Her sleeves were rolled up, reddish bubbles slipping down her arms. There were words slashed across the glass, half disintegrated by Andrea's efforts. I could make out the top half of an M, a U, R, D, E, R, I, N, G, B, I, T, C. Aw, hell. I sighed. Andrea kept her eyes down and focused on her task. Scanning the window, I saw the slightest traces of older paint in different areas of the glass. This isn't the first time, is it, Andrea? She heaved a heavy breath out of her nose.
No. Every night since the Lanieres were informed, the same message. Murdering bitch.
Well, that's just hurtful. And inaccurate.
Sometimes it's in different colors, she offered. I have a feeling that the Lanieres have been telling their tale to whoever will listen, because the handwriting has looked different on a few nights. I didn't want to tell you because I didn't want to worry you, but it's been pretty strange around here lately. Stranger than usual. The Tuesday night book club has suspended its meetings indefinitely because the humans don't trust the vampires enough to attend for the time being. The Chamber of Commerce called to reiterate that they don't want you to be a member. Several of your old friends from the library called to cancel holds they had on books on order. Between hate mail and people calling to tell us that they'll never shop here again after what you did to that poor Lanier boy, and the people coming in and begging us to turn them too, the only store traffic we've had lately has been of the crazy variety. We haven't had an in-store sale in days.
What about online? She shrugged.
Same. With the exception of an influx of orders for werewolf relationship guides out of Alaska, which is weird.
We're not so infamous that Mr. Wainwright's old customers in Cornwall don't want their field guides to pixies and fairy folk. That will sustain us, but if we can't lure back the locals, we're going to feel it in a few months.
As in?
As in, that raise I was hoping to ask you for. I won't even bring it up, she said, frowning. I slapped my hand over my face.
It will work out, Andrea assured me. Once Jamie's allowed back out in society and the truth comes out, the scandal will die down. Somebody will wander into Piggly Wiggly, drunk and topless, and everybody will forget all about you and your whole Scarlet Woman persona.
Scarlet Woman?
Seducer of young men, ruiner of lives, danger to the morals of American youth.
I got it. Thanks. Andrea hosed off her handiwork, and I dragged the soap bucket into the shop. She followed, rolling down her sleeves as I sorted through the disturbingly large stack of pink While You Were Out slips.
I sorted them into piles. Please turn me, my chronically ill parent, my dying cat, into a vampire, and you're an evil whore, rot in hell, Andrea said helpfully.
The rot in hell people actually left their callback numbers?
Well, I did ask politely. I think it caught them off guard,
she said, wiping down the coffee bar counter.
How's Gabriel? Dick said he was staying at your place tonight to keep an eye on him and Jamie.
Still sleeping, but his color's getting better. He actually has a skin tone found in the spectrum of human shades. Dick thinks he might wake up in the next day or so.
Sounds promising.
Yep. Okay, enough of this brooding crap, I grunted, throwing the rot in hell stack into the wastebasket. You are going to mix one of your evil high-octane coffee potions for me. We're going to call Ophelia and tell her about the hate mail and the window graffiti. We're going to set up a video camera to train on the front door to get proof that the Lanniers and their friends are defacing the shop, then hand the tapes over to the human and vampire authorities. Andrea made a wincing face.
What? We're going to pull a sting operation on the grieving parents? She asked.
The grieving parents who are defacing my shop and maybe playing toxic William Tell games with my fiancé?
Yes.
She winced again.
What?
I demanded.
It's just that, archery shenanigans aside, if they're just painting the shop window, I kind of understand why they're doing it. They're angry and confused, and the only target they see to lash out at is you.
When Andrea saw the incensed look on my face, she changed conversational lanes abruptly.
Which is obviously an inappropriate way to channel their grief, and the sooner we guide them toward professional help, the better.
She ducked when I slung a copy of the Guide to the Newly Undead at her.
And you need to find more appropriate ways to channel your anger. Aren't you supposed to be planning a wedding right now?
Really? I gaped at her. My fiancé has been poisoned into a coma, and you think picking out monogram napkins and color-coordinated Jordan almonds is going to make me feel better? She scoffed.
Well, no. Jordan almonds are so 1980s. I can tell from your expression you're not going to have much of a sense of humor about this wedding thing, are you?
I groaned. I don't even know where to start. I should just admit defeat now and turn the whole thing over to Mama.
So, you're okay with the ribbons on the invitation matching the aisle runner, the bridesmaids' dresses, the table linens at the reception, and your garter, all of which your mother chose because she thought seafoam green would complement Gabriel's eyes?
I shuddered and thunked my head down on the counter. I should have done a better job of selling elopement.
What you need is Iris Scanlon, she said, digging through her purse for her wallet.
Is Iris Scanlon an internet-ordained minister who doesn't ask questions? I asked, sidestepping when Andrea chucked the guide at my head. As it turned out, much to my disappointment, Iris Scanlon ran Beeline, a new daytime concierge service for vampires. She was a combination event planner, notary public, and contractor. While many changes had been made to society overall to accommodate vampires, there were still some things that had to be handled during the day. Government buildings, for one, were still only open during daylight hours, and it was rare to find contractors and service people willing to come out to a vampire's house at night. Because vampire marriage was still a new phenomenon, the wedding industry was still very much daylight-oriented. One of Iris's specialties was assisting in planning vampire weddings. It said so right on the business card Andrea fished from her purse.
Iris was exactly what I needed,
an indifferent but committed outside third party to handle the little details that would drive me nuts, but that I couldn't trust to Jolene, Andrea, or Mama without their personal tastes influencing their decisions.
She does great work, Andrea assured me. She just started up, so I wasn't able to use her for our wedding. But she helped out with Hadley Wexler's wedding last month, and she's planning Sophie's commitment ceremony to her longtime girlfriend.
Sophie from the council? I said, raising my eyebrows. I didn't see that one coming.
Call her. Make an appointment. Make your life easier, Andrea said, sliding the card to me.
Yeah, 'cause that always works, I snorted. This still feels weird, planning a wedding while Gabriel is so sick.
Consider it a hopeful gesture, Andrea said, rubbing my back. Think of how happy Gabriel will be when he wakes up and sees how much progress you've made toward marrying him.
Really?
Ask Dick how thrilled he was when I neglected to ask his opinions on flower arrangements. He commissioned a t-shirt in my honor. My girlfriend kicks your girlfriend's ass.
When I squinted at her, confounded, she said,
In Dick's way, that's the highest compliment you can pay a woman.
I will never understand your relationship. Andrea grinned at me.
Right back at you, sweetie.
I did make the appointment with Iris, and by the time Gabriel woke up 2 days later, sore and grumpy and not entirely sure what had happened to him, Iris had already sent me fabric samples for the dreaded linens, aisle runner, and napkins, and there wasn't a speck of seafoam green in sight. From her emails, Iris seemed competent, no-nonsense, and completely unsentimental about this wedding stuff. Iris was quickly becoming my favorite person. Ever. Gabriel wasn't entirely pleased with me for going to Ophelia, but I think it was more a matter of male pride than anything else. I came home to find him propped up on a stack of pillows, sipping blood through a crazy straw, because it amused Zeb, and wearing Star Wars pajamas, because it amused Dick. He was pale and drawn and still had purplish bruises under his eyes, but he was awake, and he was smiling at me.
I love you, I love you, I love you.
I babbled, kissing him over and over until Zeb pleaded that we were grossing him out. Gabriel smiled blithely up at me as I hovered over him, and then flinched as I grabbed a pillow and whacked him over the head with it.
And don't you ever do anything like that again. I am the one who ends up in stupid, life-threatening situations. You are the level-headed, responsible one in this relationship. Got it? This is how this whole thing works. We have to stick to our designated roles or there is chaos.
Dick snickered.
It's true. If Zeb suddenly starts being all dashing and sexy, what am I going to do?
Zeb took offense to this.
Hey, I can be dashing and sexy. Jolene says I'm like the human wolf man.
Jolene lies,
Gabriel told him, his voice slightly hoarse from disuse. Dick agreed.
A lot. I'm going to play Madden with Jamie. He respects me at least,
Zeb grumbled.
No, I don't,
Jamie called from downstairs.
So, Dick says I've missed quite a bit while I was out. He says you paid Ophelia a visit,
he said, threading his fingers through mine. I pulled myself onto my knees and glared at our big-mouthed friend. It's called heading a problem off at the pass, I said.
Is that a euphemism for emasculating one's betrothed while he's unconscious and unable to defend himself?
Gabriel asked dryly.
No.
It's a euphemism for accessing resources that we don't have by alerting the council to our problem, rather than playing junior detectives ourselves. They've already installed a camera outside my shop door that is so scary and official-looking that the locals stopped painting my front window. Plus, this particular choice of directions doesn't involve Ophelia suspecting me of hurting others for personal gain.
Unless Ophelia finds out that you're Gabriel's beneficiary on his life insurance policy.
Dick said, snickering.
I am?
Gabriel seemed insulted that I didn't think he would provide for me in the event of his staking.
Of course you are.
How do we even get life insurance? I asked. We're dead.
Well, not according to the paperwork I filed with State Farm,
Gabriel said. But somehow my reporting to Ophelia skirts an ethical line.
Okay. So it was the smart thing to do.
Gabriel admitted.
When did you arrive at this resources conclusion?
When I realized that I'd given Dick $5,000 and asked him to drive halfway across the state to a college crime lab for tests that may or may not have detected the poison in your system in a way that may or may not have helped us treat you, I said, glad that I couldn't blush.
Clearly, your judgment goes out the window when I'm unconscious,
he said, managing to hide his smirk as he slipped an errant tendril of hair behind my left ear.
And how is Jamie doing?
Fine. He seems to be spending a lot of time in the shower, I noted quietly, my voice so low that even Jamie's super hearing couldn't pick it up. Dick chuckled, followed by Zeb and Gabriel. What?
Remember that summer I turned 13 and my mom complained that she couldn't ever get me out of the bathroom?
Zeb asked.
Yeah, but that's because you were... I slapped my hand over my mouth.
Oh, welcome to the world of parenting, Zeb said. It's one big horrifying miracle.
Oh, I grumbled. I tried to diffuse my embarrassment by talking about Iris and the progress she was making with the wedding. Although I was loath to admit it, Andrea was right. Gabriel was thrilled that I'd made the effort to call a wedding planner. He was so heartened by my apparent interest in wedding planning that he immediately perked up, called Iris, and arranged a meeting the next evening to be followed by an appointment at a wedding dress shop in Murphy. My stomach sank at the words dress and shop, and I searched my memory banks for my list of plausible reasons I could not go shopping. I hadn't had to use them against Mama in so long that they'd receded from the tip of my tongue. Wait, how did she manage to arrange that so quickly?
She said she has her ways, Gabriel said.
Also, she's been warned about what Andrea called your unhealthy aversion to trying on clothes, so she will accompany you to the shop to provide hard liquor and moral support.
I think I love her a little bit, I admitted.
Hell, if she can sneak booze into a bridal store, I may love her a little bit, Dick said.
You know, it strikes me as sort of useless to be planning a wedding when we haven't decided when the wedding will be,
Gabriel said, toying with the engagement ring on my finger. Actually, I had an idea about the date, but I didn't want to do anything until you woke up, I said. What do you think of July 8th?
As dates go, I believe it's a perfectly respectable one.
It's Aunt Jetty's birthday. I think it would be nice to get married on her birthday.
Aw, that's sweet, Dick said. She'll love that.
And it will be so close to July 4th weekend that most of the relatives on Mama's side will still be hungover, so maybe they won't be able to make it.
That's less sweet, Gabriel conceded. But I think it's a good, strong wedding date.
And now that the wedding date is settled, you know what that means,
Dick said, gleefully rubbing his hands together in a way that made me distinctly nervous. Gabriel's voice was just as uneasy.
We can order those embossed matchbooks I love so much.
I can start planning the bachelor party,
Dick said, giving his best impersonation of an evil supervillain laugh. Or maybe it wasn't an impersonation.
This is not going to end well for me, is it?
Gabriel asked me. I sighed. Remind me to exchange some cash for pesos in late June. I don't think they'll accept American money when I have to bail you out of jail in Tijuana. Gabriel chuckled.
Still, July 8th. I'm very excited. It only gives us a few months to plan, you know.
If we don't get it done by July 8th, it doesn't need to be done, I assured him.
Be sure to explain that to your mama,
Dick snorted. I laughed and smoothed the hair back from Gabriel's forehead as he eased back onto the pillows, exhausted. My hand froze over his temple as the temperature just over my shoulder dropped by 10 degrees. I could feel frosty breath on my cheek as my Grandma Ruthie's voice slithered into my ear.
Keep making plans, little girl. This wedding will never happen,
she hissed. I immediately glanced over to Dick and Gabriel, who didn't show any sign of having heard the voice. I rolled my eyes. It would appear that my dear, departed grandmother was choosing not to reveal herself to them, targeting me for her loving messages. Grandma Ruthie's spectral presence around the house seemed to have diminished since her outburst with Aunt Jetty. There were little flare-ups here and there. My car keys would disappear. The windows would rattle. Random trash would appear on the counter. But I think that was Jamie. Jetty said that Ruthie was probably rebuilding her strength for another big blow-up. But every once in a while I was lying in bed, I would hear her voice whispering over my ear. She knew exactly what to say to keep me from drifting off to sleep. That Gabriel was going to wise up and leave me standing at the altar, explaining to my family why I would spend the rest of my unnatural life pathetic and alone, or variations thereof.
"Why would anyone want to marry you?"
She had a sneer in her voice.
"I never understood what you thought was so special about you. You're not all that pretty. You have the figure of a linebacker. You don't have any real talents. The only thing you've ever been good at is reading. A first grader can do that."
"Shut up, old woman," I grumbled, refusing to let my lips so much as tremble. Gabriel leaned toward Dick and quietly asked,
"Is this a new endearment that became popular while I was unconscious?"
Chapter 10. If you are still in contact with your sire while raising your own child, set clear boundaries with your sire in regard to treatment of your child, or you will be constantly fending off presents and bottled specialty blood from the same person who called you spoiled. Siring for the Stupid, a beginner's guide to raising newborn vampires. Iris Scanlan was everything I'd hoped for. She was a cross between Gypsy and Pixie, a tiny, compact body topped with a wild, curling mop of sable hair. She wore a knee-length black skirt and a pretty ice-blue eyelet blouse paired with no-nonsense black pumps. She was constantly scribbling notes in a small pad tucked into her leather folio embossed with the signature beeline logo of a determined little cartoon bee. Gabriel was wearing non-pajamas for the first time in almost a week and sitting on the couch, firing questions at her. I had no idea he cared so much about cummerbund colors and DJ playlists. Personally, I wanted to gauge exactly how much weirdness she could take, so I asked Iris about the weirdest request she'd ever handled for a client. She sipped her iced tea and suppressed a smile. "I'm going to have to say, being called at dawn to arrange for an animal wrangler / cleaning crew / contractor to restore a vampire's living room. Said vampire didn't know that tigers made terrible house pets until the tiger destroyed his couch and tried to chew through a wall. As a human, he loved cats. He figured he was bigger, stronger, and scarier now, so he needed a house pet that was bigger, stronger, and scarier. Apparently, he'd never seen a single episode of When Animals Attack. But the good news is, now I know how a Trank gun works." "Good. Then you're prepared to deal with my mother." "I don't understand. She sounded perfectly nice on the phone," Iris said, her brow creased.
"On the phone?"
"Yes. She called me this morning to talk about your preferences for the flowers. She's planning to meet us at the bridal shop later. Your sister is planning to be there, too." I groaned, covering my face with my hands. "Isn't there such a thing as planner-client privilege?" "Well, no. Not unless you warn me of meddlesome relatives beforehand. Also, she called me, so I assumed that you'd already talked to her about my involvement in the wedding plans." "Well, I didn't. I don't know how she finds these things out. She just does. It's her evil power." Iris seemed to sense my panic and that we weren't off to a great start to our relationship. She squared her shoulders and made another little note in her folio. "I've dealt with difficult family members before, Jane. It won't be a problem. From now on, we'll have a password. Any changes to wedding plans or meeting times will require the password before I give anyone the information. Also, I'll let the vendors know that any changes require password confirmation." I tried to make my patronizing smile a bit more pleasant. "We'll talk on the way to the bridal shop. Once you have the background information, I think you'll agree that a password's not going to do you much good." It might have seemed odd to drive more than an hour to Murphy with Jolene and Andrea in tow, but there were very good reasons that I could not go to the only bridal shop in the Hollow, the Bridal Barn. Those reasons were that it was, A, hopelessly stuck in the 1980s with scary shoulder pads and neon-colored layered chiffon creations, and B, run by Jolene's Aunt Vonnie, who had hated me since my involvement in Jolene and Zeb's wedding. I didn't think it would be wise for me to get anywhere near her while she was holding scissors or pins, or large-gauge sequins. On the way, I gave Iris a sort of highlight reel of Mama's most memorable antics. It wasn't that my mother didn't love me. Sure, it had taken her a while to get used to the whole vampire daughter thing. And for a while, after she realized that I would never give her grandchildren, she took to her bed. But she soon snapped out of it, joined the FOTU, and tried to force-feed me pot pies for my own good. The problem was that she'd seen my wedding in her head for so many years that I knew that any deviance from that vision would just not be accepted. She honestly believed that my opinions were just weak protests, cries for help for Mummy to come along and fix everything. Then again, Mama thought I would be marrying Zeb, best friend since babydom, someday, which showed how much she knew. So she washed all of the dirty clothes in your luggage, then decided that the clothes in your closet weren't clean enough and washed them, too? Iris marveled as Jolene described Mama's response to my returning from vacation with Gabriel last year. And then she ironed all of her jeans, Andrea hooted. With starch, I added, turning Big Bertha onto Yancey Street toward the Bridal Dreams boutique. The name of the shop alone was enough to have me looking for U-turn options. I was not one of those women who dreamed of poofy designer silhouettes and exotic beading. I was a realist. My pale skin didn't look good against white. Mermaid skirts made me look like a snowman, and butt bows made me break out in hives. It was nearly 2 hours after the shop's closing time, but Iris had arranged for us to have the place to ourselves for a handsome viewing fee. Through the front window, I could see that Mama and Jenny had arrived before us, and that someone had given Mama one of those rolling racks, upon which she had already hung a half-dozen frou-frou princess nightmare gowns. Andrea, I whimpered, lowering my head to the steering wheel. Yes, Jane. There's a stake velcroed underneath your seat. I want you to take it out and shove it into my chest. Tell Gabriel I died bravely in defense of democracy and fluffy kittens. Andrea snorted. That seems a little dramatic. You're a dog person.
Why do you have a stake velcroed under your seat?
Jolene demanded.
We agree that you would tell us when you have concealed weapons.
I felt a gentle nudge at my shoulder. Iris was holding a flask in front of my face, a flask completely encrusted with pink crystals, save for the little yellow crystal bee on the front. She flipped the cap open, and I could smell the vodka fumes rolling over the lip.
This is not my first rodeo, she said, shaking her head.
I think we've just been replaced as best friends,
Jolene muttered to Andrea. If the liquid courage didn't secure her place as my newest, closest companion, Iris's masterful handling of my mother sealed the deal. The first thing Iris did as she came through the shop door was exclaim over my mother's wonderful taste in dresses. Then she managed to whittle down Mama's selections by asking if she preferred the A-line skirt with the floral motif or the ball gown with the ribbon sash. Did she like this full tulle skirt or the cathedral train? Before Mama knew it, she'd been talked out of half of her picks, seated in one of the uncomfortable little tea chairs by the dressing rooms, and eclipsed as the organizer of this gathering. Jenny just sat back and marveled. Where was she when I was planning my wedding? Iris wandered around the shop, selecting dresses that were a little closer to my taste. I didn't know how comfortable I was mixing my supernatural friends and my family. I mean, sure, my parents had hosted a beautiful baby shower for Jolene, but at the time, they didn't know that she was a werewolf, and Andrea had been human then. Now that my family was aware of my friend's unique nature, I expected it to feel different. I hadn't counted on them bonding over their mutual exasperation with me. My clumsiness, my stubbornness, my ability to injure myself or others just by walking across a room, it was all the stuff of instant sisterhood.
I never thought I'd see the day Jane would voluntarily go shopping, Mama said, sipping the tea provided by a harried shop assistant named Claire.
I thought poor Andrea would have to use her vampire strength to hog-tie Jane and put her in the trunk.
I haven't read many books on vampire wedding etiquette, but I think hog-tying the bride is rude in any culture, I noted. Andrea ignored me and said,
I practically have to force her at gunpoint to go with me to shop for jeans. She always finds cute stuff with my guidance, but she acts like I'm torturing her.
Well, to be fair, she has flashbacks, my sister added, winking at me as she handed me a fluffy, full-skirted gown. Jenny, I said in a low, warning tone. Mama looked at me quizzically and then burst out laughing.
Oh, I'd almost forgotten about that.
Jolene and Andrea exchanged glances, silently debating whether the potential hilarity could be worth suffering my wrath. They grinned simultaneously. Shit. I hate you guys, I mumbled as I strode into the dressing room and took the first of Mama's dresses off the hanger. As I wrestled my way into what felt like miles of tulle, Jenny was telling the story of homecoming dress shopping with me my sophomore year. Jenny was nominated for the court, so Mama was insisting that I go to the dance to support her. Jenny, of course, had already picked out her gown before she was even nominated. But it was 3 days before the big event, and I was still lobbying to wear jeans and combat boots. Mama and Jenny had frog-marched me into the Tot Teen and Tween shop downtown to find something that won't make you look like a motherless hobo, as Mama had so gently put it. After a dozen ruffled, bow-covered nightmares, I decided I'd had enough. I yanked a dress over my head, forgetting about the zipper. The zipper got caught in my hair. I felt as if I was being attacked by the ghosts of evil prom queens and fought back. And, because the dressing rooms were framed with curtains instead of doors, she came stumbling out of the dressing room into the shop with her panties bared and her dress over her head, Jenny said, hooting. Andrea and Jolene were falling all over each other laughing. I glared at the lot of them. I think I remember why I hate shopping, I said, my hands on my hips.
Oh, honey, Mama murmured, her eyes misting. It's so beautiful.
I turned toward the mirror and flinched. I look like a bad meringue hallucination, I said. The skirt seemed to explode from beneath the bodice, making my hips look a mile wide. The hem was hovering about an inch off the ground and revealed my white gym socks. The sleeves were those padded bell sleeves, but they'd long since deflated and hung from my biceps like droopy balloons. Iris had stopped in her tracks across the shop and dropped the tiara she'd been holding.
You look like Cinderella, Mama cooed.
Behind her, Iris, Jolene, and Andrea were shaking their heads in sync.
If she was doing the walk of shame home from the ball, Andrea muttered.
Jolene and Jenny snickered. I bit my lip to keep from joining in. What? Even I can appreciate a good snark at my own expense.
You couldn't have worn nicer socks, Mama asked.
Well, baby, I'd say you have a winner